I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton,
I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing, podcats? It's Adam Buxton here. It's great to see you with my mind. Thanks so much for joining me. Here we are, walking along a dusty farm track in the east of England as the sun goes down around about the middle of August 2022. I've got to tell you that it's a very beautiful evening out here. Dramatic is the word, sky-wise. You know, it's sunset. There's some crazy clouds in the sky because we are coming to, well, the end for the time being, at least, of a heat wave here in the UK that has scorched the earth. With any luck, we're going to get some rain. Storms are forecast. Certainly the skies around here are looking pregnant with water rage, but so far, no actual moisture. Anyway, that's the weather situation. You're welcome. How are you doing? I hope your summer is proceeding as well as can be expected. I'm doing fine, thank you, and so is my good dog friend Rosie. She's up ahead, sniffing. But hey, look, let me tell you a little bit about my guest for podcast number 186, the Scottish musician, director, and one of the founding members of much-loved indie pop stalwarts Belle and Sebastian, Stuart Murdoch. I know the episode is entitled Belle and Sebastian, but it's just Stuart that I'm talking to today. Here's some very brief Belle and Sebastian facts for you. The first stripped-down incarnation of Belle and Sebastian formed in Glasgow in 1995. An expanded lineup came together to record the band's first LP, Tiger Milk, in 1996. That was the first time they all played together, that original lineup. And as far as that LP is concerned, there was a tunefulness and a sensitivity to the music and the lyrics on Tiger Milk that was, for some, a refreshing change from the laddishness of the so-called Britpop bands who had dominated the indie scene in the UK for the previous few years. And though just 1,000 copies of Tiger Milk were pressed on vinyl, word of mouth and pirate copies quickly spread, and by the end of 1996, Belle and Sebastian had signed with the Jeepster label and recorded a second LP, If You're Feeling Sinister. Another absolute peach. There have been one or two lineup changes since then, but they have kept making records. And their new album, A Bit of Previous, released in May this year, 2022, is their 11th. The band worked on the production of the record themselves with help from producer and engineer Brian McNeil. And the NME's Gary Ryan says, all of the well-worn Belle and Sebastian hallmarks are present. But what's truly impressive is how effortless it all sounds this time around. In addition to making music with Belle and Sebastian, Stuart Murdoch wrote and directed a musical feature film released in 2014 called God Help the Girl, starring Ollie Alexander of It's a Sin, Celebrity Gogglebox, and the band Years and Years. You know the guy. My conversation with Stuart was recorded remotely back in April of this year, 2022, before the release of A Bit of Previous. And as you will hear, Stuart, along with the other members of the band, Sarah Martin, Mick Cook, Richard Colburn, Bobby Kildare, Chris Geddes, and Stevie Jackson, hope I'm pronouncing those names correctly, apologies if I didn't, recorded versions of a couple of songs from the new album, specially for the podcast, and you will hear them shortly, as well as some great hot waffle between myself and Stuart. about some of the music that influenced Stewart over the years, with particular emphasis on the Velvet Underground, or at least the Todd Haynes documentary. That led us on to the subject of encounters with Lou Reed, record producers in general and what they do, and the effect that living with the condition ME has had on the way Stewart writes songs. We also spoke about songwriting in general, and Stewart was kind enough to give me a few tips. However, our conversation began with me commenting on Stewart's excellent look, which you can see a screen grab of on my website, if you're interested. There's a link in the description. I'll be back at the end, but right now with Stewart Murdoch, featuring music from Belle and Sebastian. Here we go.
Like a sort of groovy cartoon character.
I wish that was. My kids would like me more.
How old are your children?
5, Nico, and 8, Denny.
Oh, man. Hey, that's fun. That's a good age.
They say it's fun. I can think of another word beginning with F.
there is fun in there. I mean, when I think of the early years, I don't remember those fondly. But by the time they were around 5, I think I was adjusting to fatherhood a bit more and I could enjoy it.
But you've got girls, though.
I've got a girl. She came along last to shine light around and show us.
To sweeten the deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never thought I'd have boys.
Did you not?
No, I always thought I had 3 girls, like the president in the West Wing, and they would just grow up and look after me.
So when you were imagining yourself as a father, if you ever did such a thing, you were thinking of sensitive conversations with young women.
I think I just thought that they could go off and do something with the mum.
Right, okay.
And leave me in the greenhouse to be grumpy. And then, you know, just come in and give me a pat now and again, and it definitely didn't work out like that.
Yeah, 2 boys. It is an absolutely knackering thing to be a parent, especially in the early years. And you have always talked about the fact that you've suffered from chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME, and that is presumably an ongoing process of managing your life in all sorts of careful ways. When did the ME take hold and how did it come on?
That was kind of late 80s and it came on gradually. It took me about a year and a half to get to my worst. I was just giving up one thing after the other. And then I sort of bottomed out and then I had a nice 6 or 7 years of wilderness before I got the band together. So
6 or 7 years of wilderness.
I know, yeah.
What does that look like? I mean, we're talking about chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalomyelitis.
Yeah.
Also known as ME, condition that causes extreme tiredness and a range of other symptoms. So as far as you were aware when it began, when you were in your late teens, what did you think was happening?
I didn't really know. I thought I was having a poetic fall, like Holden Caulfield in Catching the Rye. I was reading that book a lot and I thought, wow, what's happening to Holden's happening to me. But it was less fun. It lasted longer. It wasn't just a quick trip to the mental ward. It was, there's a lot of physical stuff as well. It's actually my mum that she said, I hope you don't have that ME. She was a nurse. She was the first person that sort of paid any attention because the doctor didn't really know what was going on. And so, in fact, that's what it was.
How did it manifest itself for you? So it was a combination of physical symptoms lack of energy, etc., I'm presuming, and then kind of accompanying mental fog or depression?
Well, actually, the depression didn't really kick in until year three, which seems, maybe that seems weird in the scale of things, but I was actually okay mentally. I mean, my life completely changed. It's more just like your battery getting pulled. I did a lot of athletics and I was working nights, burning candles and just mad on music, just a bit mad, really, but not looking after myself. Also conflicted, a bit of confliction. That'll get you in the long run.
Conflicted how?
Well, just conflicted about what one was meant to do. A lot of pressure. I was kind of brainy when I was at school. There was a lot of pressure to become a scientist and just do science and do university. I was the first in our family to go to university, so my dad was on my case. You know, this was a big deal back in the day. There was pressure, but I realized that, you know, when I got up to Glasgow, the beloved city of Glasgow, it had a lot of attractions that weren't anything to do with science or physics or university. I thought university was rubbish. I was too young, you know, I was 17 when I went there. So I got interested in a lot of other stuff, but confliction, you know.
So you started listening to a lot of music, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's when I got obsessed with it all.
And how did that obsession take hold originally?
I got into a band with a bunch of doctors. They were all doctors, except me. I answered an advert in the student union and originally they were called Phil Opie and the Tubes.
Wow, that is really reaching.
Yeah, yeah. That you know, but they were all doctors, so that was a nice Phil Opie and the Tubes. And then they changed their name to the Seizures. And but it was nice because they used to pass me, you know, they were fun guys, and you know, we went to this basement and they gave me the only ones and they gave me orange juice and they gave me Roxy Music and they said learn these and then I threw in some of my things that I liked. I couldn't write a song then, but so that was a nice little starter.
Did you go out and see a lot of music at the time? I mean, I know that you were a big fan of Orange Juice, but were they still around even at the end of the 80s?
No, and that was like a big gulf. I got into Orange Juice, you know, around 86 or something, but they left Glasgow, I think, in around 81, 82, and they'd broken up anyway. So it seemed like a huge gulf. It felt like I was doing a detective job on the whole postcard scene. That's what got me into the pop group and Young Marble Giants, all that great post-punk stuff.
Mm. I looked at some of the records that some of your favourite albums on a Quietus article by Adrian Lobb. Lots of good stuff on there. Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Stevie Wonder, Hotter Than July, AC/DC, Yes, Beatles, Smiths, Cocteau Twins, The Fall. But I didn't see any Velvet Underground. And I, for some reason, maybe lazily assumed that they were a big influence on you.
I think that article, I was trying to do a little I remember that article, and I was trying to do a little chronological thing. I mean, the thing is, if you ask a musician what their favorite record or records are, they have so many, you know, they change all the time. So I could have picked 8 different records that day. I don't have them, sewn into the lining of my underpants or anything.
What?
In case I get run over. So I think I was trying to do a chronological thing. That was I remember when Stevie Wonder was my favorite thing, and then AC/DC was my favorite thing when I was 12, and then the Cocteau Twins. But the Velvets, to be honest, they didn't really, it wasn't till the 90s that I started looking back at the Velvets.
Have you seen the Todd Haynes documentary?
About Velvet Underground?
Yeah. I think it came out fairly recently, and it proclaimed itself to be a kind of half music documentary, half art film, avant-garde image and sound mashup. And actually, it was fairly straightforward. I don't know, it was okay, but it was like, actually, it made me like them a bit less after I watched it. Do you ever get that?
Yeah, well, that's the danger. I don't always watch too many music things. I, Bob and Stevie and Chris and the Bandit, you know, they really soak that stuff up. I tend to be a little bit careful. Yeah.
I mean, the music was amazing still. It's very good. It's never suddenly going to sound shit. And Lou Reed's voice is so compelling and cuts through everything. You can kind of, he's a bit like Marquis Smith. You could sort of hear him reading out the phone directory and there would be something entertaining about it.
Yeah, definitely. I had to sing in front of him one time.
Lou Reed?
Yeah, it was random. It was like, I was just on holiday, I think, with my wife, and there was a thing called, it was the Kitchen Organization, and it was something to do with my record label. They just phoned me up and said, you're in New York. Can you come down and do a couple of numbers? And I didn't have any instruments. And usually I don't like to do anything without the band, so I borrowed somebody's, a squeeze box thing. It's like a thing with pedals, a harmonium, like Ivor Cutler used to play. And I played an old Scottish song, Ye Banks and Braes, or of Bonnie Doon. Then I played one of our own songs, and but I thought, well, do you know what? I don't play guitar in this. So I got the fella from Talking Heads.
Jerry Harrison.
No, the singer.
David Byrne.
Yeah, because I knew he was part of the organization. I said, right, I'll turn up and do this if you could get David Byrne to come play guitar for this song.
Oh my God.
And he did.
Whoa.
And I don't think he was very pleased.
Why was he grumpy?
I think he was a little bit grumpy. I would be grumpy. I think I had more hubris back, you know, like it was 10 or 15 years ago. I just thought, well, come on, why not? That would be fun. Let's, you know, so, but Lou Reed, he was just sitting in front of me and he didn't look too happy either.
He never did though, did he?
Well, the only story I heard about Lou Reed was that it was a friend of a friend went up to him, saw him at an airport, you know, with his dark glasses. And I thought, fuck, that's Lou Reed. I mean, you've got to go up and say hello. You've got to say something. And so he walked over and he didn't get within like 6 feet of him. And the guy didn't move. He just said, fuck off, kid.
That's what you want.
He's like, yeah, I met Lou Reed.
Lou Reed told me to fuck off. That's perfect, isn't it? I mean, that really is definitely the guy in this in this Todd Haynes doc. There's quite a lot of stuff about his early years and the stuff he used to get up to. I mean, obviously he went through the ringer himself and there were all sorts of issues that he was dealing with and treatments that he may or may not have had imposed on him, like medical treatments. He always claimed that he got ECT to kind of shock the gay out of him. That's his phrase. And who knows how that affected him, but he was already quite a cranky character as far as I can tell. The only worthwhile artistic expression at the time for him, so this is early 60s or whatever, was just to confront everything that went against society's values and norms. So for him, it was all kind of gay clubs and fairly violent sex and like taking friends to really rough clubs, even though he knew it made them uncomfortable. And all this sort of behavior, which would be in no way acceptable nowadays, you couldn't really talk about it casually in an interview and expect to get away with it. You know what I mean? But that was his whole MO.
And if he, you know, if stating the obvious here, but if he hadn't been who he was, there's no way he would have written the stuff he wrote and performed the way he wrote. Nobody did.
Yeah.
And these performances are priceless.
Yeah. I mean, I guess speaking of kind of focusing on the seedier side of life, that's not a million miles away from what you were doing in early Belle and Sebastian days and marrying a very kind of accessible, tuneful, melodic pop sound with lyrics that were quite dark or talked about, you know, strange things that you wouldn't normally have in a pop song, stuff that you would normally find in a kind of gritty novel, maybe.
Yeah, I was just writing about what was around and how I was feeling. There's, you know, nothing. I didn't have anything to lose, so I didn't have to pander to anyone. I just let it out and, you know, wrote about the people around me. But even the people around me that you might think were kind of deadbeat, and they were better than me because they were well, so I could romanticize them. I thought, you know, the people that were taking a lot of drugs or messed up and sleeping in a different bed every night, I mean, that was amazing to me that people could do that. Never, but also somebody who could just get up, go to work, come home, have a drink. It was all that, you know, normal and abnormal behavior. Any type of behavior was interesting to me. So I used to write about them.
Right. So you're almost like a scientific observer.
I was a little bit.
But do you still feel disconnected from what's going on around you in the same way? Do you still feel that you're in a separate world because of ME?
A little bit, yeah. But I think everybody is in a separate world. I mean, if you want to generalize, I think everybody has their own thing going on. Their own, it's got their own movie very much in their mind. So I don't mean to say, wow, I'm unique because I had this experience or I'm having this experience. There's some very good things about the experience I'm having. So I don't want to moan about it or make it out to be so special.
Yeah. You mentioned seeing people, you know, going out and boozing and taking drugs or whatever. Was it clear to you fairly early on that that was not going to be something that you could do and manage the condition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was almost like straight edge, even to the point of like, no shagging. I mean, you know, no.
What's wrong with shagging? That would just knacker you out.
Yeah, it's just, or well, it's getting into the realm when sex would even be on the menu. I mean, I couldn't. Like, I'm talking about those long years, especially the early years, we were out of the game. And I say we because my friend Kira and I, Kira had ME as well. And we used to sit in rooms for long periods talking about the possibility of having boyfriends and girlfriends. And just talking and dreaming and talking about the past, because it was kind of beyond us. We were like, people moved too fast. We couldn't keep up, and we had the occasional dalliances, and then when they realized what the deal was, then, you know, the people quickly sort of moved on. So you had to have a bit of a sense of humor about it.
Sure. Now you have, I understand, very kindly recorded a couple of tracks, is that right, or just one track?
No, we recorded two songs for you yesterday. And I wish I could, you know, I've got an injury just now, or else I would have just played you a couple of tracks. But I think maybe, hopefully you got quite a good deal out of it, because it was nice to involve the group. And so we made this album, and then we've come back, and this is the first time we try to actually play the songs live. And they've come out quite different in the way that we played for you.
Oh, wow. Thanks very much. I'm honoured. Please pass on my thanks to the rest of the band too. What's the name of the first song?
The first song is called Young and Stupid. And it's the first record. It's the first song on the new LP. And it is a little bit of a looking back, being sad in the present moment and looking back to that particular period of being young and stupid. And we've talked about it already. That was my years before I got sick, the kind of late 80s DJing and messing around, being in other bands, yeah.
Fallopian Tubes years.
Yeah, the Fallopian Tubes.
All right, here we go for the Adam Buxton Show.
Your will and peace. kids and some with dogs, getting through the nightly slog. Flashes in the mind, you were young and stupid, keeps us warm at night. All our young and stupid makes us feel delight. We were young and stupid, makes you feel regret when you're young and stupid.
That was Belle and Sebastian with Young and Stupid, specially recorded for the Adam Buxton podcast. Thank you very much. And that is a track from the new album. What's that called?
It's called A Bit of Previous.
Hello. And am I right in thinking you're producing that yourselves?
Yeah. Yeah. Just, I mean, I think that word producer, production is a bit of a mysterious thing, sometimes a bit of an entity. And all our early records were produced by ourselves, although we never said on the sleeve. You know, we worked with very capable engineers and we are working with one this time. But we were co-producing with Brian.
Uh-huh. As you say, it is still a mysterious thing with a producer, isn't it? Because I think I always just assumed the producer comes in, he sets up the mics, he or she sets up the mics, although there aren't many female producers. I think that is something that is changing gradually.
No, we've looked for them. I think it's changing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But certainly in the olden days, it was a world that was dominated almost totally by men. And they would come in and I thought they would set up all the mics, plug in all the guitars, make sure everything was recording and balance all the faders and things like that. But actually, generally, it seems to be that that's what an engineer does. And the producer just swans in and sits there and goes, oh, what about a rap around the middle eight section? Am I right?
Rolls up a massive joint.
Yeah, exactly.
But it can be. It's a sliding scale. You do get, I mean, the thing is, a good producer will know that if what is needed at precisely that point is just to simply come in and roll up a joint or make tea, they will do that. They'll be like, you know, there's some magic happening. I can already hear it. Just let it happen. But it could be like the band never showed up and they've got to start making the record and they start, okay, well, let's dig out a drum machine. Let's make it. So they can be doing everything. They could be doing nothing. We were with one of the most famous producers of them all, Trevor Horn. That was the first time we actually worked with a producer and it just happened to be Trevor Horn. And sometimes we'd be, you know, we'd be bogged down. We're trying to get a thing going. We were in his manor house in Oxfordshire. And he'd say, let's go and put a rocket up. And he had these rockets that he got. I don't know whether they were pneumatic. I don't know. But they went thousands of feet in the air. You know, we went to the middle of the field and all the dogs came with us barking madly. And he had these, we were in the four-wheel little tractor things that go fast. And we'd put a rocket up. And he said, yeah, that it raises the spirits. And then we go back in and do something else.
Good one. That's Trevor Horn's secret for creative success. Put a rocket up.
Yeah.
Maybe Elon Musk should produce a few records. Trevor Horn, that's cool. Were you a fan of his stuff when you were young? I always remember seeing Video Killed the Radio Star on Top of the Pops and being completely besotted with that.
Yeah. Oh, it's classic. It's fantastic. Single, but I was a Yes guy. I was like a prog rock guy.
Yes man.
So I was a Yes man. I had this secret thing. You know, everyone was like, "Oh wow, Frankie, Grace Jones, ABC," and I was like, "Trevor used to be in Yes. I mean, he was right in them. I mean, he produced them, but he was in them."
That's right. I forgot about his Yes years because "Owner of a Lonely Heart" was very good when that came out. That sounded very futuristic, as did so many Trevor Horn productions. What was that like for you, though, going in with the Belle and Sebastian record? Were you sort of, what were you hoping to get from working with someone like him?
Yeah, we were hoping for Owner of a Lonely Heart, but it didn't work out. You know, we were hoping for Art of Noise, but he was really, at the time, which was 2001, 2002 that we were with Trevor, and I think it was his daughter that had heard one of our records and played it to her dad and said, you should get these guys, and so we did, and he just loved that, you know, we played as a band, and he loved that experience of just recording us all.
Yes, and that was Dear Catastrophe Waitress that you did with him.
That was, yeah.
I heard you talking about, this was around the time that your film came out in 2014 that you directed, God Help the Girl, and I saw you doing a Q&A maybe in South by Southwest or somewhere like that, and you were talking about the fact that you sometimes might be just jogging or something like that, and a song will arrive more or less fully formed. You can hear it all in your head. You can hear the arrangement. You can hear the strings. You can hear the tune, even the lyrics sometimes. Is that right?
I'm very flattered that you kind of remembered me saying that. It's funny that you were in the audience. I think it was.
No, I watched it on YouTube.
Ah, right. Okay. But even so, yeah, there was a very specific instance when the first song of that movie, the thing that made me write the film, was something that switched on like a radio while I was out running in Sheffield on a dark night along a canal path. But that was, it wasn't me singing. The reason I could hear like a radio was somebody else was singing. It was a female vocal, which hadn't really happened to me before. And that's why I ended up going on that diversion.
Is that something that happens to you a lot, though? I've heard other musicians talk about that kind of thing, talking about almost channeling songs, feeling as if they haven't really written something, but they've just been, it's almost just arrived fully formed, you know, people like Brian Wilson and musicians like that. I just find that miraculous. And does that still happen to you?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I'm not saying it's miraculous, but that's the way most of them show up. Most of the ones that I author myself, that's kind of the way, usually just when I'm waking up, or just suddenly you'll get a feeling, you'll get a feel. And Brian Wilson used to talk about feels. They weren't songs, they were like a little feel. You get the idea for the song, and it's quite often a rhythm, and rhythm and melody, and then maybe, you know, I let the words ride along with the melody, because the first blush of words that come along, even though they can be inconsequential, you quite often end up leaving them in. So that's handy to jot those down too.
But do you ever write in a more sort of straightforwardly workmanlike way? And if so, how does that look?
So less often I do that. I'm usually the slave to the thing that we were talking about before. But the interesting thing about being in a group is that an opportunity presents itself to write in different ways, which is terrific, because you've got your own tunes, you've got a handful of those, and then one day you'll come in, Chris is playing a great riff on the Wurlitzer keyboard, and he says, I've got this feel, and I say, okay, that's great, let's do it. And everyone starts jamming, for want of a better word, jamming over the tune, and that's an opportunity to come up with a different melody, to suggest a progression and write some words, and those words will end up being very different from the kind of words that you would write yourself waking up in the middle of the night. So we're very lucky. I think all those different types of writing are by being in a band, you are presented with different challenges.
I'm always amazed that you just seem to have this unending wellspring of tunes. Like every single Bell and Sebastian tune that I can think of is interesting. It's got hooks. It's pretty. It's memorable. Over the top, emotional sometimes. But there's always a lot going on. Do you know what I mean? Do you ever consciously try and write very different stuff? Or just almost squeeze out all the tunefulness and think, all right, I'm going to go for something dour and grey and indie sounding?
Yeah, I know.
Like
it's funny. Probably not. I think life seems too short not to kind of give it your best shot. It was always my thing from the early days was beauty, beauty, beauty. You know, joy. Try to get the joy in there. I can't really sway from that path. Like I say, it just seems like time is tight. I mean, you know, maybe we should set ourselves a project. Sometimes you do think, well, maybe we could write a song about this. Let's write a political song. Or try to give myself a challenge. Let's write a song about chocolate biscuits. You know, let's see how that turns out. I think there's people in the band that are more enamored of that idea than I am. I tend to fall back on what I'm better at. Sorry, the reason I mentioned chocolate biscuits is because yesterday while we were recording your session, we were going through all the 70s and 80s TV adverts for chocolate biscuits that we could remember, which was fun.
What were some of the good ones?
If you like a lot of chocolate on your biscuit, join our club.
It's a banger.
And you can stand it with Bandy. The trouble is that we found that so many of them were kind of vaguely racist. You know, they were, for some reason, there was kind of racist overtones in a lot of the...
Yeah. It was the glory days of racist advertising.
So,
and there was, at the cinema, there was the Kiora ad. Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
It's too orangey for dogs. What was it? No, it's too orangey for crows. Yeah. Crows. Too orangey for crows. It's just for me and my dog.
And Bongo and all that. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Things you simply can and shouldn't be talking about.
No. But very memorable tunes to go with them. Yeah. That was the thing. It was insidious.
Yes.
If I wasn't doing what I am doing, whatever I am doing, I guess I would probably be a jingle writer in an advertising agency. Because I don't think that I can really... Well, I'm trying to write some songs at the moment. I don't know why exactly. I got a record contract off the back of the podcast because I think they just wanted to release some of the jingles that I do. And they thought, oh, well, you've done loads now. We'll put them out. But then I thought, well, I've got a record contract. I should write some songs. I should do an album.
Totally.
And so I've been trying to write songs that are longer than 30 seconds. And it's really fucking hard. It's so difficult. And also because I've never written anything serious before. It's like everything just has to be silly and...
Yeah, you're a funny guy.
Thanks very much. But I also have lots of not funny moments and moments that fall way short. And maybe they're mildly amusing at 30 seconds, but... Not for over 2 minutes, you know what I mean?
Have you ever thought about getting with some guys? And I say particularly guys because if you've got a problem with 30 seconds, just get with a couple of, you know, a drummer and a couple of guitar players. That 30 seconds will soon become 10 minutes. You know, just get with a couple of guys who are into Can or Beefheart and they'll extend your shit.
That's a nice image. Yeah, that's a good idea. Get jamming with some blokes, some middle-aged blokes.
But seriously, I mean, there's so many ways of taking your idea and turning it into a song. And anything can be, any little nugget of music can become a different style. Do you mess around with GarageBand?
Yeah, man, that was where my music potential was suddenly unlocked because I never had any... discernible musical talent. And so I never did any music lessons. I just assumed, well, that's something that musicians do. That's something that talented people do. They learn how to play guitar and piano and they understand all that stuff. So I never ever did it and was always jealous of people in bands. And then I got a computer and it had GarageBand on it. I was like, holy shit, I can just whack together these loops and it sounds almost like a song. And it was wonderful. Like, this week I tried to record a song playing guitar and bass, just DI'd into Logic. And it was really good fun. But, you know, just the physical limit, I just can't move my fingers fast enough. So I'm only on 3 chords and it just sounds so horrible. Like if you squint, then it sounds maybe like a kind of very indie lo-fi thing from the early 80s or late 70s or something. In fact, like a Go-Betweens demo or something.
I mean, that sounds great. I mean, that sounds great to me. I'm thinking, wow, that's a, you know, because things sound very clean these days. And when something comes on from that era, it has a thing.
Yeah.
That I'm into.
Well, it's definitely organic. But then the problem is, well, what do I sing over this stuff? And, you know, my tendency is to be silly, but I feel like I've got to battle it to say something sincere every now and again. And then my sincere sentiments are so mortifyingly rubbish.
I could see why it's tricky. It's difficult to move from one thing to the other when you have, and it's not even other people's perceptions, it's the perception you have of yourself. It's, you know, you're battling a few things, but that you maybe just need a little trick or a little something to allow you to find a new thing. And maybe it would be getting into a room with a couple of people. I mean, for years when we got into a new album project, the word on top of my page was collaborate, exclamation mark. Just remember how good stuff comes from collaboration.
Yeah, I think you're right. But all these things are easier to do when you're in your late teens, early 20s. You don't have a family, you don't live out in the middle of nowhere, you're not 52. And all this, you don't have all the other shit that comes along with being a bit older.
Like, again, you know, just it might not be quite the same thing, but maybe bouncing an idea over to somebody and having it bounce back. Or else you could just have a long debilitating illness.
Okay.
And then, you know, just get some, you know, get the mumps for a while.
You don't hear about the mumps so much anymore.
Yeah, you don't hear about the mumps. Proust had mumps, didn't he? He had a, you know, and then he wrote Remembrance of Things Past.
I didn't know that he had mumps.
Well, I'm not sure if he did really have mumps, but he had something.
What is mumps?
I don't know.
Is it sort of a glandular thing?
Yeah, it's one of the three M's, you know, MMR, isn't it? Mumps, measles, and rubella.
And rubella, that's right. But it's the one with the most fun name that sounded like a kid's TV show.
Yeah. You swell up somewhere.
Yeah.
There's a bit of swelling involved. But once you're over the swelling, you'll be able to write to your heart's content.
I mean, measles, mumps and rubella does sound like a sort of Belle and Sebastian type indie band.
I don't know why that concept album hasn't been written.
Hello, fact-checking Santa here. Mumps is a glandular infection that causes painful swellings on the sides of your face. It's easily prevented by the MMR vaccine. Also, there was a New York dance punk band from the early 2000s called Measles, Mumps, Rubella. There's a link in the description to their music, which sounds quite good to me.
Okay, time for more music, I think. What is the name of the next specially recorded Belle and Sebastian track, please, Stuart?
It's called Unnecessary Drama.
Tell us a little bit about this one, if you could, please, Stuart.
So Bob wrote this. He's a riffy man, and he brought this in complete, as he always does, in a military style, and tells everybody what to play, but it's good. He always gets good ones. He commissioned me to write some words, but he told me it had to be called Unnecessary Drama.
So we're going to hear that now. But it's so nice to talk to you, Stuart, and meet you after all these years. And I mean, I say that because, you know, I was a fan back in the day, and it was an exciting time to be a music fan when Belle and Sebastian started putting out music, and Tiger Milk came out, and it was this rare item that only the very coolest people were passing around. And it's like, look, I've got the original artwork, and hey, this is just a photocopy of that. You've just got this off some other guy. And it's like, no, this is an original copy. And it was really cool. And, you know, that was around that time at the end of the 90s is when I met my beautiful wife. And many of your songs soundtracked those early years of us being together. And Lazy Line Painter Jane is the one that reminds me so much of the intense emotions I was feeling in those days. Epic, stirring song. Sorry, I'm just sort of gushing at you, but I'm really grateful to you for coming on and talking to me and to the rest of the band for recording these songs.
Thank you, Adam. It's been an honor. It's been lovely.
Letter from before. you're just telling me to draw me in. There's an array of douchebags lining up to play their stupid parts. And did you ever pause before you give your love away? This is my life. This is my so-called life. This is my life. And this is my heart. Holding close to mother, she was ashen with the strain. And there was miles to go, yeah, miles to build that sister loving bond. And then I figured that the music set your soul.
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Eight. continue.
Hey, welcome back, Podcats. That was Bell and Sebastian playing a song specially recorded for the podcast. Did I mention that before? I can't remember. It was specially recorded for the podcast. I'm very grateful indeed to Stuart and to the rest of the band. I have linked to some Bell and Sebastian related bits and pieces in the description of today's podcast. What have we got? You got your tour dates. They are touring throughout the UK and Ireland and further afield later this year. You've got a video for a song they recorded earlier this year in support of people affected by the war in Ukraine. If they're shooting at you, it's called. Link to that on YouTube. Link to Lazy Lion Painter Jane, just in case you're not familiar with it. Good video as well. There is a documentary put together by Pitchfork called If You're Feeling Sinister. Ironic, because I think Pitchfork absolutely slated If You're Feeling Sinister, the album that is, when it came out in 1998. And they have... They said it was... I'm trying to remember. I think I read this on Wikipedia. But they said it was a parody of the band's earlier work. It's a parody. Three albums in. It's a parody of their earlier work. It's a great album. Anyway, they have since withdrawn the review. The review's been cancelled. And a more positive review was written in 2018. What else have I got here? Oh, yeah, the trailer for Todd Haynes' Velvet Underground film that we talked about, which is good. I mean, it's worth seeing, especially if you're a fan. But, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I was in a weird mood when I saw it. Oh, I can feel a couple of spots of moisture. And I'm not talking about my pants. Sorry. Here comes the rain. Thank you, Weather Jesus. Okay, I should wrap up. Thank you very much, once again, to Stuart Murdoch, Bell and Sebastian, and Noam Klar from the label for helping arrange everything for this podcast. Much appreciated. Thanks to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for his always invaluable production support and hard work. Thank you, Seamus. Thanks to Helen Green. She does the artwork for this podcast, and I love it. Thanks to Acast. They are always helpful and work hard to keep this show on the road. Much appreciated. But thanks most of all to you, because I know, what do they say on airplanes? You have a choice, and we're grateful that you made this one. I hope you don't regret it. And that you come back another time. I hope that things go well for you and all your dreams come true. And I was wondering if we could have a hug. Is that okay? Come here. Let's have a sensitive Bell and Sebastian hug. Okay. That's enough of that. Oh, one last thing. I love you. Bye!